Good evening, and welcome to Profiles, a program where we are able to talk to the people who help make a difference in South Central Indiana. This is Bob Willard. I'll be your host tonight as we discuss what's happening in the Columbus area with Sherry Stark, who is the recently made president and CEO of the Heritage Fund of Bartholomew County, and before that was the executive director of the Columbus Area Arts Council.
That's right, Bob.
Okay,
exactly.
Well, thank you for being here and making that long journey over here. Bloomington has the same situation. We have an arts council and we have a community foundation. Could you explain the difference between the two so that we're familiar with where you are now and what you did before?
Well, Bob, I'd be happy to try,
okay.
But let me put a little flag on that I'm still very new at the Community Foundation. So anybody who wants to call in and suggest some other ways they're different or similar, I will defer to them. The Columbus Area Arts Council is a regional arts council. When I took the position with the Arts Council, we were responsible for the community of Columbus, the county of Bartholomew, and the contiguous counties around it. At that time, though, something really exciting was going on. The Indiana Arts Commission had approached 12 different organizations around the state to develop partnerships where the arts councils would be handing out the state's funds to arts groups within that region of the state. And here the Waldron Arts Center is part of that with Frank Young involved. So although I began with a regional arts council, the scope of whom we were serving and what all we were doing expanded tremendously, which was really exciting. So we now serve a 9-county area in terms of funding and technical assistance. That's the Arts Council. The Arts Council raises money. The Arts Council gives out money. The Arts Council in Columbus presents shows and provides all kinds of services and supports and a ticket office. Okay. That,
right.
Bob, is the Arts Council.
Okay,
then you
that.
Turn to the Community Foundation. The Bartholomew County area is served by this foundation, and its purpose is to serve the people in Bartholomew County. So it, frankly, has a bit narrower geographic focus, although rather than being focused only on funding and support of arts and cultural activities, it is for anything that is for the betterment of the county. So a difference. A community foundation, as I learned at my training, so now I know everything because I've had one day of training.
Well, it's one day more than most of us.
Well, there
had,
you go. So. And I really did listen very hard, Bob, so
okay.
I do know a lot from one day, is that a community foundation is a vehicle, receives money, dispenses money, as opposed to being a charity.
Isn't the Heritage Fund the recipient of Lilly money and so forth?
Yes, it is. The Heritage Fund is one of the oldest community foundations in the state of Indiana. It began in 1976 as a result of some leftover money from the Columbus area's Bicentennial Commission. We had some extra money and some very generous people, and they provided the seed money to create the foundation. During these past years, particularly since 1990, Lilly has been working in a very focused way to support communities across the state in creating foundations. So they've provided quite a bit of money, hundreds of millions of dollars across our state. And again, at my training, I learned that out of our 92 counties, Indiana now has 95 community foundations. So from a handful to 95 in less than 10 years is really remarkable.
And this has been mainly funded by Lilly money?
That's right. But Lilly doesn't just give it to you and walk away. It's a match program. It's to help create the foundations and then to grow them and develop them.
But you give scholarships, though.
We give scholarships. We also provided funding to help expand our downtown park. We were very involved in the expansion of our Foundation for Youth, Boys Club, Girls Club. Many soft side issues, social service issues. But scholarships is a very big part of what we do, and we are so thrilled to have just completed the Lilly scholarship process. We were able to provide 4 years of full funding for 2 high school graduates in our county to attend Indiana universities, one of the state universities in Indiana, or I think a private one too, as I recall, but 4 years of tuition and all expenses through Lilly money. And every community foundation has that ability now, which is remarkable.
What are the requirements for a student to do this? My curiosity's piqued here.
Well, when you think kind of philosophically, why is Lily doing this? I believe it is part of Lily's intent to support the best and the brightest of our young people and to encourage them to stay in the state of Indiana so that we don't have what we often hear called the brain drain. So the idea is to give a full ride scholarship to high school graduates if they choose to stay in Indiana for their undergraduate work. And in that way, Lily's really investing in our young people and hopefully retaining them in our state.
Well, now you were born in Lafayette and you're in Columbus, so you've not left the state except for
short visits.
So.
That's right, Bob. And I have to say, I'm sorry, all of you Bloomington people, I do have to say go Boilers because I grew up in Lafayette and still bleed gold and black, although I did not go to Purdue except for nursery school.
Well, some people think those are synonymous. So
I had to throw it in.
Why don't you tell us how you went to Purdue's nursery school?
You want to hear the cod liver oil story, don't
you,
Bob?
I want to hear the cod liver oil story. I'm going to make you tell it.
I'll be glad to tell my cod liver oil story. Purdue has a good program for working with educators. And when I was a little girl, which was in the 40s, my mother would drive my sister and brother and I over to Purdue, and we went to their experimental nursery school. And what I remember most about it is walking in the brick building and being fed cod liver oil after lunch. We also had naps, and we'd go out in a little play area. And that is really the extent of my being a Purdue student, except for one summer school many years later.
Can you just sort of follow how you went from Lafayette to Columbus and what, you know, where you went to school, what you've done, the things that have helped prepare you to be the president and CEO of the Heritage Fund?
Well, gosh, one of the things, Bob, that I tell young people, if I'm talking to, say, a group of scouts or students, is for them to be aware that everything they're doing as children and as young people and as students is really preparing them for where they're going to end up later in life. And certainly I use myself as an example of that. In grade school, I was a typical kind of tomboy, active gal, did a lot of playing outside and all that, because that was really before the years when girls were in athletics. So it was more the cheerleading and climbing trees in the backyard. I did have an opportunity to explore different things that I might have just in Lafayette by the camps I attended in the summer. And now most camps are 2 or 3 week sessions, but in those days, I went to 4 years of camp in New Hampshire, and those were 2 months long. And an interesting part of the camp I went to in New Hampshire, which was called Ogons, was Thursday night was poetry reading night, which is really kind of different. You know, we had canoeing and archery and swimming and horseback riding and hiking and nature studies, but we also had poetry reading. And I remember that we did choral reading as a part of that. And as I think about how I then in high school got involved in poetry and was involved in contests with poetry reading, and how later at Northwestern University my kind of double major emphasis was theater and interpretation, I look back and think some of that came probably out of Ogons Camp, Ogons White Mountain Camp for Girls, as it was called, up in New Hampshire, and those early poetry readings on Thursday nights. Then as an adult, as a volunteer, I have done some work on radio and have done some interpretive reading for different events in our community. And I wonder, does that all go back to those Thursday nights in the White Mountains of New Hampshire when I was a little girl?
Well, probably did.
Probably did.
You found that it was okay to speak in front of a group.
That's right. That's exactly right. High school was at Lafayette Jeff, which was a very big high school because we didn't want to split into two schools because we wanted to have a good basketball team. Because this was in the 50s when basketball was king in many ways in Lafayette. And I can remember going 2 years while I was in high school to the state basketball championships with Lafayette Jeff and being so thrilled for the Broncos. And those were happy, wonderful years. I was very active in organizations during high school and was drawn into two different fields that tie around communication. One was writing and one was speaking. My writing was with our high school newspaper and speaking was with our speech team. And we had a wonderful teacher and coach, and we went on to win state. In fact, I don't know that I've kept the skills, but a zillion years ago, I won the state championship in radio announcing many, many years ago. During my summer before my senior year in high school, I was trying to think, what do I want to study in college? And my thought was perhaps journalism or perhaps something about speech. And I had the opportunity to come to Indiana University and go to the High School Journalism Institute, which was for high school students. And let me say, it was a marvelous experience. I think it was 2 weeks long, and it was really hard work. We were treated like college students. We were expected to deliver. And what I learned was writing was really hard work. It was a struggle. You know, you had to think about it. You had to fine-tune it. And talking was so much easier. So when I came back from the Institute, one of the ahas or light bulbs that went off was, I think I would be better served to pursue a field of speech than a field of writing. But I will say that all of that writing I did in high school and the newspaper work I did has stood me in very, very good stead. When I'm interviewing people at my different places of employment through the years to hire people, I look for somebody who can write well and speak well. Almost everything else can be learned, but if you can't communicate clearly, you're already a several steps behind. So I'm very appreciative of all that journalism background.
You mentioned a while back cheerleading. Now, is that something you did? Because you seem to be one who pushes for things that are when you get enthusiastic.
Well, you're right, Bob. I am. I have trained tour guides in Columbus. For about 10 years, I trained the tour guides. One of the things I would tell the tour guides, who are all volunteers, is people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And that is very much an underlying philosophy in my dealings with people, to show them how much I care. Maybe that cheerleading is a piece of that.
Why don't we take a break here and listen to some music? What did you bring for us that we could listen to now?
I guess I would start with my favorite conductor, because it's my son, Eric Stark, and I hope we'll have a chance to talk a little bit about him later. But he was the artistic director of the Masterworks Chorale in Muncie and was so thrilled when they put out a CD, and he gave me a copy of it, and I presented, I listened to it. I have to be honest and say it's Christmas music, but I think Christmas music is wonderful to hear year-round, and this piece is one of my very favorites. It warms my heart and sometimes even makes me cry, and I just wanted to share it with everyone.
And the name of it?
It's Night of Silence by Daniel Cantor.
With the Muncie Masterworks Chorale conducted by your son, Eric Stark.
That's right.
We have just heard Night of Silence, a composition by Daniel Cantor, performed by the Masterworks Chorale from Muncie, Indiana, conducted by Eric Stark, the son of our guest today, Sherry Stark. Do you want to talk a little bit more about Eric's career?
Oh, gosh, Bob. Do we have hours and hours?
No, you get a few minutes.
Okay. I'm a proud mother of three sons. I also have a wonderful grandson and another on his way, so I have to give equal billing that way. Eric is my oldest son, and I'm so proud of what he's done. And he certainly has ties to this listening audience because he used to work for WFIU when he was completing his master's here at IU. He graduated from Wabash and is presently on the Butler faculty. He is teaching choral conducting, has the Madrigal Group, the Men's Glee Club at Butler, a university choir, and also the Indianapolis Arts Chorale, which is a community singing group in Indianapolis. And he's the minister of music at Central Christian Church in Indianapolis.
Sounds like he has a passion for choral music.
He certainly does, and he's doing all he can to educate me.
Okay, well, that's good. And you have two other sons.
I have two other sons. Christopher, my middle son, is a Hanover graduate, married to his college sweetheart, Anne. And they have a son, Austin Kirby, and are expecting a second one this summer. Christopher's in finance. He also is very involved in junior achievement, which was a love of my father, Kirby Risk. And so I love to see Christopher carrying on that tradition. He teaches project business classes in the Indianapolis area.
And Brian?
Brian Stark is wonderful, crazy Brian Stark. My youngest son also graduated from Hanover, and the listening audience might have seen some stories about him. He recently became the first person to ever travel the American Discovery Trail on foot all the way from Delaware to California, almost 5,000 miles. He ran it. Went 20 to 40-some miles a day and did get quite a bit of media coverage, so people may be familiar with Brian.
Well, he also ended up on television.
Well, yes, Bob. You know, here he is, this person who loves nature, wearing a 9-pound fanny pack, sleeping on the ground, doing all these terribly simple things for 5 months, at the end of which he got on The Price is Right and won 8 teddy bears, a trip to Hawaii, and a trip to Canada.
You do a lot of things or have done a lot of things in the Columbus area. Rather than read them, can you just sort of talk through all the things that you've done for the community there, including running for mayor?
Oh, okay. I graduated from Northwestern University and was in theater and interpretation there and also got a teaching degree. When I came to Columbus, one of the first things that, and that was in 1972, one of the first things I did was take my grandmother, who was visiting, on an architectural tour of Columbus. Well, I was just blown away by all the buildings. I knew I was living in a special place, but to see them pointed out really deepened my enthusiasm. And as I listened to the tour guide, I thought, well, I could do that. I could be on the front of the bus talking about these buildings if I knew anything about buildings and architecture. So I volunteered to learn, became a tour guide, and for 10 years trained the tour guides as well as serving on the Visitor Center board. I think that maybe as much as anything was what introduced me to the community of Columbus, developed my skills at interacting with people, and gave me an opportunity to be noticed by local people. For example, when the trustees from the MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art in New York, Mrs. Rockefeller and the group came, I got to be the tour guide. Well, that was wonderful fun, but it also gave me the opportunity to meet with the leaders of our community as I introduced these VIPs around. So that in some ways opened doors for me, which led to my being invited onto a number of civic boards. So I've been president of our hospital foundation, president of the Service League, which is like a junior league in Columbus, have been on the Chamber Board, the Enterprise Development Corporation Board, which is our business incubator. It was on the precursor to the Columbus Area Arts Council Board, which is was at the time called Driftwood Valley Arts Council. I was president of Distinguished Visitor Series. Anyway, lots of different community organizations, and all of them such fun.
Well, you were involved with the Chamber of Commerce, too, were you?
Yes, on the Chamber of Commerce. Because my father, Kirby Risk, started a small business, which is now, I'm happy to say, very successful in a number of states, I grew up around small business and have a really high regard for business people and the business community. So it was a wonderful opportunity to step over from some of my kind of mommy volunteering and community volunteering into the business sector to be involved with the Columbus Area Chamber of Commerce.
Were you in deputy mayor?
Yes. Now, that was interesting. I was in Hawaii and got a phone call from Robert Stewart. And I have to say, I said, Robert Stewart, who would that be? My husband said, well, that's Bob Stewart, our mayor. I said, well, what in the world is he calling about? So I returned the call, and Bob Stewart said, Sherry, my director of community development is leaving. I want to fill the job. Would you be interested in taking that position? And so when I got back from Hawaii, I met with him, and I said, Mr. Mayor, I don't know anything about politics. And he said, you don't need to know about politics. I know about politics. I need someone who knows the community and can work with the community people. And I said, well, I've been doing that for years as a volunteer. I think it sounds like fun. I'll do it. And he said, would you like to read the job description? And I said, well, okay. And I took it, and oh my gosh, Bob, it was 3 pages long, and it was all about federal regulations and do's and don'ts. And the mayor said to me, now, Sherry, I only ask 2 things of you out of this position. And he said to me, I don't want to end up in jail, and I don't want to get shot.
So that's your job description.
That was my job description. You work with this community and be sure we don't end up in jail or get shot. And I took that very seriously, which I think was appropriate. And so that first year, I was scared to death. You know, every federal thing I signed, I thought, am I going to go to jail? Because they're just full of all this legalese. It was really scary to start with. But gosh, did we have fun.
Well, obviously, you didn't get shot.
Did not get shot. And that was during the 10 years when Columbus was in an economic downturn because of downsizing by our major industries. And so we were on a very aggressive effort to recruit new business and industry. And we had some wonderful, wonderful times. We led the renovation of Mill Race Park. We got started on the Front Door Project, which is now coming into fruition. We created Project Self-Sufficiency, which was enabling people as the early precursor to the welfare to work. We had some wonderful programs going and had great, great fun doing it for 10 years.
Let's go back a step. You said you did a lot of volunteer work, and yet then you moved into the political and the community business cycle.
Right.
What preparation did you learn from all the volunteer work that stood you in such good stead in these other positions?
Well, Bob, I think all my experiences in life were what prepared me, and an example that I've told people when I've spoken to groups about how do you get from there to here is I was busy being a community volunteer, got a call one day from Paul Bippen, who now is dean of Indiana University, Purdue University in Columbus. And at that time, and this was in the early 80s, he said, or mid-80s, about 83, 84, that Seymour had called him, and Lilly was offering a grant if they could create a leadership Seymour, and they needed someone to help them figure out how to write the grant application, and they'd called IUPUC for help. And Paul knew me because his wife and I were involved in a women's group, and he knew I'd done community things. He said, do you think you could put together a grant application like that? So he and I drove down to Seymour, met with the Chamber of Commerce, talked to them about how wonderful it would be for Seymour to create a leadership development program, and that, yes, it would be just nifty to put together a grant, and Sherry would be the one to help them. And so they hired us. So on the drive back, Paul said, will you do this on behalf of the university here? And I said, sure. So he let me off at home. By now, it was about 6:30 at night. I jumped in my car. I drove down to our library, and I started looking up books on grants because I'd never written a grant before, a grant application. So I checked out a few books on how you write a grant application, wrote the application, and Seymour got the grant. And IUPUC turned around and hired me to come on staff and head up their non-credit continuing education classes.
So because of the volunteer work and the experience you had there, you were, even though you had to go to the library, were prepared to do this.
Well, I think as a volunteer, you gain confidence that you start with kind of nothing. You have to figure it out, make a plan, and then do it. And you don't have a secretary, you don't have staff, you just do it. And so although I had not written a grant application, I know how to read, and it's kind of like a cookbook. I got the book and figured out how you fill out an application, did it, and they got the money, and there we went.
Oh, and you had some journalism experience.
There you go. The IU School, the Summer Institute.
That's it. We found the solution.
There it is. Or Purdue Nursery School.
Well, why don't we have some more music now and move on afterwards? What would you suggest that we listen to now?
Well, Bob, it seems to me a segue into food would be appropriate here, since I just talked about cookbook. And because I have most recently been the director of the Arts Council, and we do a lot of family programming, one of the wonderful entertainers we had this last January was Red Grammer. And he used to be one of the vocalists with the Limelighters. And he was great fun, and it was a terrible ice storm. We had a very small audience, but he gave a terrific show. And this is one of the songs from his CD, Buen Appetito, by Red Grammer.
Popcorn, pizza, fish sticks, and fries. New England clam chowder, hamburger surprise. Zucchini with clams, manicotti vermicelli. And fat, crunchy pickles from the Second Street Deli. Chitlins, cracklins, black-eyed peas. Chili con queso, that's chili with cheese. Turnip beans, jelly beans. Young guy, Kalaskis and chutneys and chicken pot pie. Buon appetito,
buon appetito.
Ba, ba,
ba, ba.
Chuma sapi dinga,
chuma sapi dinga.
Bell and a well shaped pie.
Bell and a well shaped
pie. Hummus and jicama and honey baked ham. And congee, kebabs made with lamb. Langosta, that's lobster. Calamari, that's squid. I even had octopus, I tried it, I did. Poojee and kinchi, poo-poo and poi, gainam wamba.
We have just heard the selection Buen Appetito from the album Hello World, sung by Red Grammer. It was a selection by our guest, Sherry Stark. Sherry, you ran for mayor in Columbus, and we didn't cover that a minute ago.
That's right. And that was certainly a significant part of my life story. And it was a very positive experience. I'll go to the bottom line first. I did not win, but I would say it was a very positive experience. I think it's really important for people to put their names on the line when they believe in things and to take that risk. And we are going to be a very sorry country if the only people who are willing to get involved in politics are kind of the quotes politicians. You know, I bristle when people talk about politicians because I considered myself and frankly still consider myself a public servant, somebody who cares about a community, cares about its people, and wants to give back because I've been so richly blessed. And that's why I ran for mayor, and that's why I continue to serve my community.
So you've been a cheerleader for Columbus.
A cheerleader for Columbus and love doing it. When I was running for mayor, I decided to try to go to every door. And I started in April, and except for Sundays, every day after work, I would knock on doors until dark. And I went to over 6,000 houses.
Holy cow.
It was a very positive experience, except for one dog bite and one man who came to the door in a towel. But beyond that, people were very gracious and very friendly. I made a lot of new friends. The disheartening thing was that the number of people who voted were less than the number of people I met in that campaigning.
Oh.
And I thought, this is really, really sad that people don't care enough to vote, whomever they would have voted for. It's disheartening when people don't vote. And it was really of concern to me that many people had no questions about issues, often didn't even really know an election was going on, wanted frequently to talk about the school system and the school budget, which is not part of city business, would ask me, one man asked me, are you a grandmother? And I said, no, but I hope to be. Well, that made him happy. Another person asked me if I were married. People asked me about gun control. But most people just thanked me for coming to the door. It was really interesting, an interesting experience. Had a lot of fun. A lot of good people were involved in the campaign. It was a very clean race. My opponent won, Fred Armstrong, and he's a good person. Again, it was a positive experience.
You have had opportunities to leave Columbus, I'm sure, and yet you remain there. What is it about it, about Columbus, that makes it unique in your eyes?
Well, you're right, Bob. I think we all at different junctures in our life consider where we're going to go and what we're going to do. I am deeply committed to Columbus, to its quality of life, to the aesthetics of the community, to the can-do attitude. I like the size of it. I like its location. My roots are very deep there now. It is where my community and my support system is, so I am happy to be in Columbus. There is something that lifts my spirits to drive down streets and see beautifully landscaped buildings and beautifully designed buildings and to see sculpture and to see art. But the real payoff is that that kind of an environment, I believe, attracts really good people and retains really good people. So when all is said and done, it goes beyond the buildings to the people who are there. That's what keeps me in Columbus.
You went to college to go into theater or be interested in theater and speech. Did you ever have a chance to utilize those talents other than as in public forums, in political or in volunteer situations? Were you ever a chance to do theater work? Did you ever teach? Did you ever have those opportunities in your life?
Yes, I did. I grew up at a time when women typically expected to get married and often wanted to kind of assure they had some kind of a career to fall back on. So people often were advised to get a nursing degree or a teaching license, and that's exactly kind of where I was. So at Northwestern University, I did get a teaching license for grades 6 through 12 in speech with an English minor, but my emphasis was on theater and interpretation. And following my marriage and being married to a Navy pilot, we traveled quite a bit. I did theater in at least one of our locations. When we were in Brunswick, Maine, I did theater at Bowdoin College. I did Reader's Theater and also some Shakespeare. Not Shakespeare in Love, but just Shakespeare. Once I moved to Columbus, I did some theater in Columbus early on. Frankly, at that point, the theater program was pretty casual. And having come from Northwestern, where things were very, very serious, I decided to pass on more involvement for a while. I have, through the years, done some interpretive reading work, but I have not gone back on the stage in terms of theater.
You went to college with some people who made some nice careers, at least in acting.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. And this will be a test now, the trivia test for people's age to see if they know. Who among our listeners can tell us the stage name of Paula Ragusa? Paula Prentice was at school with me. In fact, we played sisters in Comedy of Errors, which was kind of a comedy in and of itself. Paula one day decided to do my makeup because she felt I wasn't doing my makeup correctly. So she put makeup on me the way she made herself up. And if you know Paula Prentice, she's tall and very striking and wonderful cheekbones, very dramatic looking, and I'm just kind of a plain person. Well, she contoured me and shadowed me, and I got on the stage. The director's booming voice came from the back as soon as the stage lights hit me. Sherry, what have you done to yourself? You know, get off the stage and start over, because it was totally wrong for me. But she was great fun. And her now husband, Richard Benjamin, Dick Benjamin at the time, was also at Northwestern with us and involved in productions with us. A very talented man. Karen Black, whom I directed in several things, was also at Northwestern with me. And Margaret was there, although I didn't work with her. David Seltzer, whom you see mentioned often, Larry Pressman was a little ahead of me, but we overlapped just a little bit, Lawrence Pressman. So there are a number of people. And in the early days after Northwestern, I'd see lots of my classmates doing commercials or small bit parts in movies and TV.
Oh, that's always fun to say, I know that person.
I know that person, yes. My family used to get really fed up with it.
Did you have a chance to teach theater at all?
I taught speech. I didn't even realize I was going to like it. I was just getting the degree because it was smart. But during my student teaching in Highland Park at the end of my senior year at Northwestern, I finally walked in a classroom, and it was like the sun came out. I absolutely loved it. The students were wonderful. It was great fun, and it was a very positive experience. So following my marriage, I did some substitute teaching as we traveled around. Now, that wasn't a great deal of fun, but it was some money, so that was good. My one long-term teaching, if you can call it, Bob, was one semester at Crawfordsville High School prior to my getting married. I taught sophomore public speaking and had a great time and made some really good friends in Crawfordsville.
You mentioned some interesting experiences when you substituted in Texas. Can you just share those?
Oh, my gosh. I tell you, these were some inner-city schools. The first day I substitute taught. Now, keep in mind, I had just come from a semester of a love-in with the Crawfordsville students. They came to my wedding. I loved them. They loved me. So I came into substitute teaching thinking, here we go again. They're going to love me. We're going to be so dear and close. Well, the first day, the students locked me out of the classroom. I went out to investigate a noise, and when I tried to come back in, they'd locked the door. And I had to crouch down below the window in the door, wait for a student to come by and say, knock on the door, would you? When he knocked on the door and they looked out and saw a student, they unlocked the door and I went zooming in. Oh, I was so angry. The next time I went there, I kept the principal's son after school. And all the other teachers said, Sherry, you'll never be called again. Well, I was called every day after that. And I learned my trick to being an effective substitute teacher. I found the biggest, fattest hardcover book I could find. I would walk in at the beginning of the day. I'd slam the book down on the desk so it would make a big cracking sound. All the students would jump. These were middle school students. That's what I was always called to teach. I said, do you see this book? And they kind of look at me. I said, I plan to stay after school today and read this book. And anybody who gives me trouble is going to stay and work on homework until I finish this book. And I kind of start like that, you know, very serious. And that seemed to work. Now, I still did have one bad experience, and that was when I was teaching PE, which I'd never taught in my life, and one of my students came up to me and she had a BB in her ear because the bullet had ricocheted off a brick wall. Another time in, where was it, Corpus Christi, Texas, I substitute taught in an inner city school where we locked up all the textbooks between classes while the classes moved from room to room so the books wouldn't be stolen. And at the end of the school day, the students, the girls were dismissed 15 minutes ahead of the boys to give them a running start. That was kind of scary.
Wow. It's much more fun to run for mayor, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's easier to run for mayor than some of that.
Why don't we relax a little bit and hear a little more music? What would you like to play for us?
Well, maybe something kind of mellow. I really love Tony Bennett, and this is East of the Sun, West of the Moon by Bauman, and it's from his Perfectly Frank album, which I first heard on WFIU.
Well, great. Let's hear it.
I wish that we could live up in the sky, where we could find a place away up high. To live among the stars, the sun, the moon, just you and I. East of the sun and west of the moon, we'll build a dream house of love, dear.
We have just heard East of the Sun, West of the Moon as sung by Tony Bennett from his album Perfectly Frank, the music of Frank Sinatra. It was a selection of our guest today, Sherry Stark, who is the CEO and president of the Heritage Fund of Bartholomew County and has been everything else in Columbus. And we have a little more time, so I just want to ask you one final question, or one that we can mull over here for a while. If you were to name the lessons you have learned in life that you would like to pass on to people, what would those be?
Oh, gosh. I'm still learning a lot. Perhaps the biggest theme I carry around inside myself is a desire to give back in gratitude for all I've received. And in my community of Columbus, I feel very deeply and very sincerely a responsibility and an obligation to serve the community because of the generations of benefactors who have created the community it is. And one of the things I try to tell other people in that community, and what I will be trying to say through my position as head of our community foundation, is we each must do our part to give back to our community. And I would say this is the same for Bloomington or Terre Haute or any community. No matter where we live, We are the recipient of wonderful things because of people who've gone before us. And we each must use our gifts to give back. And if you're somebody who likes to talk as I do, you find ways to talk and be in front of people and try to instill some enthusiasm in them. If you're a hands-on person, you do it in that way. But that's kind of my message.
You said earlier that everything in life prepares you for the future.
That's right.
And that's your philosophy and gift you at hands-on. Nothing is unimportant.
That's exactly right. And the things which at the time seem so silly, playing Tarzan and ordering all my friends around climbing trees, was perhaps part of my leadership development. You know, everything we do is preparing us for the next things we do. And I would say to people listening, be a little conscious of that. And one of the techniques I've used with staff as I've worked with people and led different groups is to ask the question, what is the lesson we've learned from this experience? And take it and apply it into our future work.
What a great way to end.
Thank you, Bob.
Now, before we go, you have a story about the Grieg Piano Concerto. Could you tell us a little bit about it, and we'll play that as we go out tonight?
Well, one of the gifts that I've been given in life is the opportunity to take some trips with my mother, Carolyn Risk. And we went to the Scandinavian countries several years ago. And when we were in Bergen, Norway, we went to Edvard Grieg's home, which is called, and I'm not sure the Norwegian pronunciation, but like Trollhagen. And it's out in the country. And the water is so pure, and there are rushing waterfalls and deep lakes and clear sky and crystalline air and rich green forests and this little home nestled in the middle of it. And it was like music was in your soul as you walked through these surroundings, and to realize this is where he sat and composed. And then they played some of his music. And it was really spiritual. It was a wonderful, wonderful moment for me and a wonderful gift. And I bought this CD at that time. And each time I play it now, I see Edvard Grieg's piano and the window that looks out on that water and those lakes and that sky. And I hear this music in my heart.
Well, let's all of us have that opportunity. This is with the Bergen Symphony Orchestra, with Alden Kaiser as the piano and Karsten Andersen as the conductor. This is selections from the Grieg Piano Concerto. It was the final selection of our guest today, Sherry Stark, who is the president and CEO of the Heritage Fund of Bartholomew County. And Sherry, thank you so much for being with us.
Bob, tonight. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for your hospitality.
I've certainly had a good time. This is Bob Willard. The program is Profiles. The station is WFIU, and thank you so much for spending the time with us.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in March of 1999. Production assistance came from Michael Pazkash and Christina Kuzmich. For WFIU, thanks for listening.